talking about Noah tonight. We're not talking about a lot of the things that we know about Noah, but we're going to look at some perhaps things that we don't talk about very often. But the story of Noah begins in the genealogy record in Genesis chapter 5. So if you'll turn back to Genesis chapter 5, this is when we first learn of Noah. And last week we noted that God blessed Abraham and Eve with another son, and his name is Seth, after Cain had killed Abel, and that it is through Seth that we have the Messiah, so he is in the lineage of Jesus Christ. And God had blessed man, and he had commanded them to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over all of the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air, over every living thing that moves on the earth. And so you see that happening in the record here in Genesis chapter 5, because what you find is when you find a genealogy like this, is you find that there are births, and we're given a lot of information about how old they are, when they gave birth, and things of that nature. And all of that is very interesting. I know Caroline has been very much interested in her own family genealogy of late. She's traced them back to all kinds of royalty, so you just need to know that we're in the presence of some royalty here. But, you know, that bug hasn't hit me. But at some point in time, most individuals find an interest in that. I've got many of genealogies that's been handed to me of my family on my mother's side, on my dad's side, and so a lot of work's been done. But we have that record for a purpose. There's one man that stands out, and I didn't mean to hit the button, so I may have given the answer away, but there's one man who stands out in this record who did not die. And I'm not asking you to answer, but do you remember who that was? God took him. And that man is Enoch. In Genesis chapter 5, let's look at verse 21, and we're leading up to the birth of Noah. Genesis chapter 5 and verse 21, Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. And after he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. There is a book that's called the Book of Enoch that you can get online, PDF, that some say that it is a book that he wrote all of those years ago. It's not, as we studied a little while back, it's not in what we would call the canon. It has not been accepted as Old Testament scriptures, but it is something that you can find and download and might find curious to read. His son is the oldest recorded man in the Bible, 969 years. I remember as a child that was one of the questions we would ask. Who's the oldest man in the Bible? Methuselah, 969 years old. Enoch walked with God for 300 years. And this is when we could really just press on one another and say, don't tell me that you cannot walk with God for your lifespan of about 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 years. That's crazy. This man walked with God for 300 years. So yes, we can do that. We ought not to fool ourselves into thinking that we can't walk with God. So he was 365 years old when God took him. 365 years old. Now, people don't live that long anymore. A quick family tree is found over in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 1 to 3. And I do want you to turn over there just to show you that in interesting places you find exactly what we're talking about. This is in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. In the first three verses, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Cana, Mahel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. There we are. We're already down to Noah. So it's interesting that there's where you would find just bam, 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 bam. There's a genealogy there. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 5, we find in this record of those of faith, we have Enoch mentioned here. Hebrews 11, verse 5, by faith Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death. So when it says God took him, it's very clear in the Hebrew writer defines that very clearly by God taking him, says he didn't die. And by faith, he was taken away so they did not see death and was not found. Why? Because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Now we could stop right there and make the same point. Don't you tell me you can't please God. This man was very pleasing to God. That's a mindset. That's a will. That's me surrendering my will to the will of God, finding happiness and joy in doing that, recognizing that God is not giving us anything that would harm us. He's giving us all the things that we might live godly, might have an abundant life, might have a joyful life, might be able to handle the circumstances of life, the ups and downs, the challenges, because God is the one who is leading the way. So Enoch walked with God, and Enoch pleased God. And that says a lot about him. In Genesis chapter 5 and verse 29, Noah is born. It says, and he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." Now, when we studied Adam and Eve, God cursed the ground. That was Adam's curse. You're going to have to work it. You're going to have all kinds of problems. But apparently, you know, they lived in this beautiful garden. They're cast out of the garden, and things weren't like they were. It was much different. And it's interesting that in all places right here, we have his father, when he's born, making this statement. He says, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." That's a prophecy. That's it. This child of mine is going to somehow do something that is now going to remove the curse that God had placed upon the land. Did you know that about Noah? I know I don't generally talk about that, because I usually talk about Noah building the ark and the things that he did and the size of it and why he did it and how he did everything God told him to do, and he made it out of gopher wood and all of those types of things. But Noah is born, and his father says that he will comfort us. Now, go to our scripture reading, which Brother Crossland read for us over in chapter 8, verse 20 to 22. And I've got a couple of things highlighted here on the screen. "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake." God told that to Noah when he came off the ark. And he also says in verse 22, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest." Remember this morning, I made that comment. God provides for us. God loves us. Right now, we're in the middle of the harvest. I mean, just look at all the pumpkins down there at Rick's Market. Did I get that right? Rick's Market. Just seed time and harvest. And we see the up on the mountain, I see a lot of dust clouds because they've picked their crops, and now they're starting to till them and get ready for the winter, whatever they might plant or something of that nature. Cotton is going to be, before long, there's going to be cotton all along the road here. Did you know that? I always thought it'd be smart if we could figure out a way to collect all the cotton that falls off the cotton trucks all along the highways. I'm like, you wouldn't have to grow it. You could just pick all the leftover stuff up and figure out some way to go down the road with your flashing lights and pick it all up. Probably make a mint just doing that. But that's about to happen because seed time and harvest. So this is a fulfillment of what Lamech said about his son. So after the getting off the ark, God says, "I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to curse the ground." Now, when he gets off the ark, we normally talk about what? The rainbow. "I'm not going to destroy the earth anymore." And every time we see a rainbow, we're reminded of that truth. And it is so sad that we could have a group of ungodly and wicked people hijack something like that and make it their banner. But they have. But every time you see that rainbow, you need to think about God's promises to mankind. So Lamech's prophecy for his son came true. Now Noah's name means rest. Let's go to Genesis chapter 6, 1 through 4. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also afterward where the sons of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old and men of renown. Now let's talk about this for a second. Let me back up. In just real quick, Seth is... In Genesis chapter 5 and verse 24, Enoch, 32. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Who's the oldest of the three? You would think by that you'd say, well, Shem, and then Ham, and then Japheth. No, Japheth is the oldest. Shem is the middle child, and Ham is the youngest. So why did it do that? Well, it goes back to promises. Who's the Messiah going to come through? And so you know that's why he's highlighted first. And to make sure we understand why that is, Jacob and Esau. You've got Jacob and Esau. Which of the two did God bless? Jacob. Guess who's mentioned? It's not Esau and Jacob. It's Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau. That's what you see happening here. Now, I have a bonus question for you. All right, so Jacob, Israel, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, had 12 sons. Which son did the Messiah come through? We've been talking about Shem, but which, obviously, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, but which son? You remember? That would be Judah, the tribe of Judah. You just got to remember, Jesus was of the tribe of Judah. And David was of the tribe of Judah, and so he is of the tribe of Judah. Genesis 49 shows where Jacob was blessing his sons, and the scepter would not leave Judah. So we learn that Judah is, in fact, the tribe that the Messiah would come from. So if you go to the genealogy, you're going to find Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Judah, on down to David, right on up to Jesus. All right, so we're all familiar with the story of Noah building the ark. So now we come back to Genesis or chapter 6, verse 1 through 4. Didn't mean to get sidetracked there, but I wanted to make that point as well. All right, so I shouldn't throw everybody in there, but I usually start there in verse 5. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and we talk about why God destroyed the earth. What in the world is going on in verses 1 through 4? We've got the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. We've got giants on the earth. And we've got the offspring of the sons of men, of the sons of God, and the daughters of men are called mighty men or men of renown or noteworthy or, you know, nobility, but they have a name. They're ruling class, if you would. Well, first of all, some suggest that the sons of God are heavenly beings. Maybe they're angels. And basically they're saying, okay, they're fallen angels and they came down to earth and they procreated with the daughters of men and then you had a super race. Have you heard that before? And that comes from where several of the translations, where it says there's giants, the King James and New King James translates the Hebrew word giants, the New American Standard, and the ESV, you have the Nephilim, correct? You have the Nephilim. Well, boy, if you wanted to go learn about the Nephilim, I would suggest you be very careful, because if you go out on the web and you say, tell me about the Nephilim, there's no telling what you're going to find. But some have suggested that what's happening here and the reason things are so bad is spiritual beings have somehow, the sons of God have come down to earth and they have procreated and they've made this super race. Is that what's going on here? Well, that's raised, a lot of questions. Who are the Nephilim? Well, if you look up what Strong's, and again, we rely heavily on Strong's, not Thayer. Thayer is just New Testament words. Brown, Driver, and Briggs, you'll hear preachers say BDB. Well, that's another like Strong's, and what they're doing is they're taking, what does that Hebrew word mean? So you look at, well, what do they have to say? How was that used way back when? It's defined as a bully or a tyrant or a giant. And the Hebrew word is, it's like Nephi. It's close to Nephilim, but you'll see that it, how they get Nephilim from it. Who are these tyrants? Who are the Nephilim? Is the text telling us that angels or non-human beings came to earth, took female humans for their wives, and gave birth to some type of race? These mighty men of renown. That's the way a lot of people look at this. Is that what's going on? Well, let me just ask you a question. Can you think of a few things that you know about angels that simply does not fit this idea, therefore it would be rejected? I'll give you a second. Just think about that. What do you know about angels? Well, angels are spiritual beings. And Jesus makes this point about himself. Look at Luke chapter 24. This is after his resurrection. He has not yet ascended to the Father. And he makes this statement. He says in chapter 24 and verse 39, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see I have." So there's nothing of a spiritual being and the flesh that would be able to happen. So we're not talking about these spiritual beings somehow. They don't have flesh. But what else do you know about angels? Well, we learn when Jesus was talking to the Sadducees and their misunderstanding or their error in thinking that there aren't any angels of things of that nature. In Luke chapter 20 and in verse 34 to 36, Jesus answered and said, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are counted worthy to attain the age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. But even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are raised when he called the Lord, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, for all live to him." The angels are not given in marriage. That's one of the, they don't marry. They're not capable of having a physical relationship. Just things that we know about spiritual beings are not able to have a physical relationship. So that doesn't fit, that there's some type of these heavenly beings that come down. So who are the sons of God? We've got three people here, if you would, three groups. There's the sons of God, there's the daughters of men, and there are the Nephilim, the giants or the tyrants or the bullies. Well, look carefully at chapter 6 and verse 4 again. Chapter 6 and in verse 4. "There were giants on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men." They were there before and they were there after. They were already here, whoever these sons of God are. So they're not the ones who come down and then, so that's not reading that text correctly. But if you look again, the Nephilim were on the earth before the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they were after as well. Now the word Nephil, the Hebrew, is used also in Numbers chapter 13. So what we're doing here now is what we're is you can take this would have been much more difficult in years gone by. All I have to do is copy the Strong's number. Is everybody familiar what that is? So all of these Old Testament Hebrew words are given a number. And you can take that number and you can plug it into your search, and it'll show you every time that number comes up. And so you can see every time that Hebrew word is used. So when we come over to Numbers chapter 13 and verse 33, notice what it says. Now this is the spies being sent into the land of Canaan. This would be Joshua and Caleb and the 10 other men that I couldn't tell you one of the 10. Can anybody name one of the 10 of the 10 men that said we can't do it? Who do we always talk about? The two that said we can. So, look at what it says in verse 32 and 33. They gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours the inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Now I'm curious, I didn't think to do this, but is Nephilim used there? It is used in yours. See, again, you remember I talked about consistency? So here, is it saying the Nephilim, those that were there back in the beginning that came down and gave birth to children and this super race? Or is it just talking about there were men of great stature, giants? Well, there were giants. Goliath was 9 foot, 6 inches. He was a tall. And I suspect if you put, he wasn't a pencil. I mean, he had like a bowling ball on the end of his, a weaver's beam that he chucked. So, I mean, he had to be a big guy. But he was a giant. And there are giants that are mentioned. There's a giant that's mentioned that had 6 toes. Do you remember that story? All right, so there are giants, and we see that further. And so that's what we're talking about, men of great stature or height. So let me just kind of give some conclusion of thoughts here on this section. So how do you understand Genesis chapter 6, 1 to 4? Well, you have the sons of God. Now, if you look at, go to chapter 4 of Genesis. And I want you to see what's said about Seth. "And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord." I think it's right that many have concluded that the sons of God are those who from that point begin to call on the Lord. And so we would say, well, that would be the descendants of Seth. Now, some suggest then that who are the daughters of men? Well, you remember Cain was cursed, and Cain was sent away. We've got this population on the earth. And there's a lot of questions that revolve around, now, wait a minute, Cain was worried about being killed by somebody when he goes away. Where'd they come from? Do you hear those kind of questions? Yeah, there's a lot of things God just doesn't tell us. It's very possible that God made Adam and Eve, but he didn't stop there. Like, did he just make one chicken? And, you know, one hen and one rooster? Or did he make several? I don't know. But what we're pointing out is that Seth's began to call on the Lord. Cain was of a different, and so perhaps what we have is we have descendants of Seth, we have descendants of Cain. And the sons of God were corrupted then over time. We've got several genealogy or generations, I should say, here, which you can see very quickly there in that 1 Chronicles chapter 1 passage. You know, that's a lot of time that goes by when you have turn, especially as long as they're living, correct? So you can have a lot of, in fact, most of the genealogy will say, and they had a lot, they had sons and daughters. How many would that be over the course of 365 years? God said, be fruitful and multiply. So there was multiplication going on in these families. We're not given numbers, but that is what they were commanded to do. Now coming back, those that call on the name of the Lord in Acts chapter 4 and verse 26, that's the sons of God. So again, Galatians 3 and verse 26 identifies those who have faith in Christ Jesus are the sons of God. And so there's those that are following God, and then you got the daughters of men. It would have seemed that the best understanding there is they're the ones that aren't following God. And so there is this sons of God, the righteous, marrying the wicked, and guess what? Now you come back, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man, verse 5 in Genesis 6, was great in the earth, and there every intent and thought of his heart was only evil continually. Things just went bad. To the point that God was sorry he had made man in verse 6. And now you kick into, okay, now you've got the story of Noah building the ark. The major point of the text is God sees what's happening. If you were just trying to step back and look at this from what's verses 1 through 4 and then leading into 6, what's this talking about? It's talking about God's looking down on his creation and he knows exactly what's going on. He sees that the intent, the thoughts of man is just only evil continually. So he decided, I'm going to have to destroy him. But that's where Noah comes in. He's sorry he made him, but he decides, I'm going to destroy man. But that's when we find Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 6 and verse 8. The Lord said, I will destroy man, verse 7, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I've made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Why Noah? Why Noah? Why did Noah find favor or grace in the eyes of God? Well, we're told Noah walked with God. Noah was 500 years old when God called him. Don't tell me you can't walk with God in our vapor of a life. You caught where he says, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he indeed is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. And you begin to see God saying, that's too long. That's too long. Sister Inez Taylor, we'd visit her at the assisted living, and she was 96, and she'd go, that's too long. That's just long enough. That's just too long. And you'll find that a lot of people, when they get up to that age, they're ready to go on. It's too long. It's getting hard. And so they're ready to move on to the next phase of life, and that is to rest until the coming of the Lord. Noah walked with God. We also learn that Noah was a just man. In verse 9, or righteous man. And he was perfect or blameless in his generation. And I tell you, we tend to say, well, wait a minute, we got to define this word perfect and blameless, and we want to push it down about as far as we can get it to where, you know, nobody can do that. Jesus is the only one who's perfect. We can't. What's it trying to tell us? It's trying to tell us you can live your life and live it well. Does that mean you, when you sin, what do? Conscience kicks in. You know the guilt, and you say, please forgive me, and God forgives you, and you move on. But it's not like, Father, forgive us of our many sins, because all we do is sin all the time. No, we're called to be perfect and blameless. We don't want anybody having a charge against us. We don't want anybody to say, oh, I know who that is. They worship with you. Think about what that does. And so here's a man that in his generation, people looked at him and he was perfect. It reminds me of Job. God says, if you consider my servant Job, he was in his generation, he was a wonderful person because his faith and his objective was to please God and to walk with God. When everybody else around him, Noah, or Job, more Noah than Job, we're back to Noah, was wicked, but not Noah. But not Noah. And so we have him who is walking with God. You go to Hebrews chapter 11 and down from Enoch, you find where God in the scriptures through the Hebrew writer brings up Noah. And I'm thankful we have this passage because it gives us some more insight. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen. Now, if you walk by faith and not by sight, you know that just like Noah, when God said, there's going to be a flood, and you're going, I don't even know what that is. What's that going to be like? He didn't say it because I can't figure it out. I'm just not going to build an ark. Guess what we've been told is going to happen? The Lord's going to burn up this earth, melt the elements with a fervent heat. That day is coming. And by faith, we're divinely warned, aren't we? What was my faith going to do? Am I going to believe that? Am I going to live a life like Noah? By faith, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. And so here is Noah who, what did he do? He prepared an ark. And that's when you talk about what a daunting task. I am so thankful for my electric Sawzalls and everything. I don't think I would have lived without my Home Depot and my Lowe's and my modern day stuff. It took him a long time, but he did it. And it was for the saving of his family. Eight people. That's it. Got in the boat. Peter uses this, of course, in 1 Peter chapter 3 to talk about important things. Verse 20 and 21. Who formerly were disobedient when once the divine long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. So why did God wait? Well, he was patient. There were people. It's kind of like the same thing that we're trying to get people to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, be added to the church, because that's what Jesus is going to save. And we're told God's long-suffering today because he doesn't want anybody to perish. So you can understand what he's saying. God didn't want them to perish. In the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which few, that is, eight souls were saved through water, there is also an antitype which now saves us, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience towards God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So he saved his family when he built the ark. Just eight precious souls. And so in his building the ark, it says in verse 7 of Hebrews 11 that he condemned the world. And so basically, when we think about him condemning the world, well, Noah was wise when he pleased God. The wicked are foolish. And the wicked, because they were foolish, they perished. His righteousness, how does it condemn the world? It shows the folly of unrighteousness and wickedness, doesn't it? I've often pictured it this way. In eternity, somebody's there and they're thinking, nobody could do that. And God looks to his right, and there's the redeemed. There's you and I. They did it, so could have you. That was your choice. So your righteousness and God's grace has proved that their foolishness is why they perished. One's good conduct is a testament against another's bad conduct. See, you want that contrast. It's supposed to, maybe it's what causes somebody to stop and think. It's what it is to be light and salt. So in doing so, Noah became the heir of righteousness according to faith. That sounds like God laying to Abraham's account for his working faith. See, when Abraham was told to go, he went. When he was told to offer his son, he did. And God said, that's it. I'm going to lay righteousness to his account. And that's exactly, he is an heir of righteousness. We study Noah to talk about somebody who was pleasing to God. Now the Bible, with a few exceptions, and I can only think of a few. Really, the first one that comes to mind is Joseph. It is hard to think of anything that that young man did that was wrong. About the only thing that you might be able to wonder is when he kind of made his brothers sit on the fire for a little while. And you wonder if that wasn't him just getting a little bit even. But outside of that, I don't know. The Bible just doesn't record it. But not with Noah. The Bible shows us some of the ugly things, too. I want you to turn over as we close to Genesis chapter 9. Because after he and his family get off the ark, it says in Genesis chapter 9, verse 20, Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. So Noah became a farmer, and he began to drink the wine from his farm. Now, by implication, this is intoxicating wine. And I understand, and I believe this is true, you take grapes. You might try this sometime. Get some grapes at the store. Put them somewhere and forget about them. And tell me that's going to be anything that you're going to want to put in your palate. I'm not sure that it's going to be anything that you would think about. There's a process and things that people do to make some type of strong drink. But I'm just pointing that out, that this is an intoxicating drink because Noah actually got drunk. And what we learn is when you get drunk and you lay down in your tent unclothed, what we find is his younger son being cursed because he saw his father's nakedness, went out and told his brothers, and God cursed him for seeing his father's nakedness. There's nothing good from what happened. And I'll just tell you, it's another little glimpse of it. There's nothing good about alcohol. Not one thing. Not one thing. And that's why you don't fool with it. You don't play with it. You don't say, well, I can handle it. You don't say, well, just a little bit won't hurt. Doctor says a little bit a day. You just stay away from the stuff. What we have today isn't anything like what they had. And don't, the only thing the scriptures say is Paul told Timothy to use some for some type of medicinal purpose. And unless you got some kind of medicinal purpose and you're hitting the bottle of NyQuil all the time and getting plastered on it, you just stay away from that stuff. The Bible never puts it in a good light, not one time. And I've gotten so tired of saying, what happened to that young man? What happened to that young lady? Started drinking. And it has completely ruined their life. Noah, just in that little story, shows us that nothing good came about him lying down naked and getting, because he was drunk, and what it led to. Now, as we close, some lessons here, I have them up there. God always knows what's happening on the earth. If you just want to bring out some points, God always knows. Walk with God. Enoch and Noah did. The righteous are to be separate from the wicked. Come out from among them and be separate, we're commanded. Don't try to dabble in it. Be separate. Are you in the world? Yes. Can't leave the world. But you can influence for good. Don't let the evil influence you. And don't be deceived and think that you can handle it because you can't. You got to steer clear. And you need to have a purpose when you're trying to reach the lost. And I would say also that you need to heed the divine warnings of our own judgment day. That day is coming, and we're one day closer. This day is fading fast, and it's still, we've got a night to go through. Will the Lord come tonight? We need to be ready. We just don't know when the Lord is going to be told by His Father, go. And then He comes. And then we'll have that judgment day, and things will be fixed. If you're here tonight and you're struggling with these types of things, and we can pray with you and for you, we want to do that. Encourage you, if you need to be right with the Lord, we encourage you to do that. If you need to be baptized to wash your sins away, we want to encourage you to do that also, as we all now stand and sing.